Hi. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, September 3rd, 1996. In the Creekside Room this morning, our speaker is Bob Keller. Today, he will be beginning his series on the Columbia River. Today's session number is 1 and is titled, Columbia River, Conflict and Self-Interest. Let's listen in.
I'm Bob Keller, and I think I met most of you last night. Is there anybody besides the students who weren't with us last night? Well, I'm not going to review it all. We mainly traced the course of the Columbia River and its main features, and then did some thinking about the nature of rivers and how people think about them. And we followed that with a 1937 film on the Mississippi River. 1937 is the same year that Bonneville Dam was built, and Grand Coulee was almost completed. So the government who produced that film was the film told us what the government was about and what it was thinking at that time. Toward the end of that film, after about two-thirds of the film showed all the disaster that humans had created with the Mississippi, recall they then shifted to how the human beings and the person through the New Deal and the federal government was going to solve the problems. And somewhere in there, the narrator made the comment, exactly how it goes, something like, what man has destroyed or what man has ruined, man can also repair. And the rest of the film was how, even though we've made mistakes and destroyed the river, the countryside, the forests, that if we just stop and think about it and be rational and plan and give power to, in this case, the federal government, we can solve the problems that we've created. We can correct the damage we've done. We can discuss that later, but it seems to me that kind of optimism about human history and about our ability to fix our problems was quite characteristic of the 1930s, the New Deal era, and that kind of optimism has, to some degree, maybe a large degree, slipped away from us. That people in our time, 1996, 60 years later, are much more skeptical and doubtful about being able to fix international problems, military problems, environmental problems, or even interpersonal problems. Well, today what I'm going to try to do is to have us have some experience with that, to try to see how it is that we've come to be more doubtful and dubious about our human capacity to correct our errors, correct our ways. So that's most of what we're going to do this morning. Before that, however, I'd like to just mention a bit about some bibliography, some good sources on this subject, and explain briefly to you the things I've posted on the walls. The books on the board are all books about the development of the Columbia River. The first one's an old one. I think it's still quite good. It's especially good if you're interested in how people were looking at things in the 1950s and about the time of that film we saw yesterday. It's by Stuart Holbrook called The Columbia. It's a very easily written book, easy to understand. The advantage of reading it today, it gives you some sense of how the river must have seemed to people back then. Holbrook's old enough at that point and has lived on the river, and he still has a sense for the river as a river. The river in our time has become a lake, not really a river, most of it. And he's right there what's being transformed from a river into a lake, and he captures a lot of that sense of the power and magnitude of the Columbia. A more recent book is by guy named Robert Clark, River of the West. That's really just a series of about 10 biographies of different people who've lived on or near the river. It's also very easy, interesting reading. A book that's not easy reading, but some of you mentioned last night about Grand Coulee Dam and the effects of Grand Coulee, especially on the landscape of eastern Washington. This is the best book now about what's called the Columbia Basin Project, the plan to literally transform central and eastern Washington from a desert into an agricultural garden. Pitzer's book talks about how that was planned, how it came about, and the implementation of it. And he basically thinks it was a very good idea, so he's sympathetic to what has been done. An older book that's still very good on the economic development is by a man named Meinig, a geographer. It's called The Great Columbian Plain. It's published around 1965-67. It's also not easy reading. It's about 700 pages long, but it has an enormous amount of detail in it about what has happened to this part of the world. I'm just interested in picking up the section, just looking at the sections about Lake Chelan, Wenatchee, city of Chelan. You find out all kinds of amazing things about this part of the world, including all the early railroads that were running around through here. A readable book about the construction of Grand Coulee Dam is by Murray Morgan, called The Dam. It's a very short little book just about how the dam was built. A longer book on the same subject is by Sundberg, Hale, Columbia. Well, all those are dam books. But some people might say there's a worse dam subject than that, and that is Hanford. And this book by Michelle Gerber, On the Home Front, is a history of the Hanford nuclear project. It's a history of the building of the first atomic bombs and nuclear energy in the United States. Since then, there's been three or four more books come out on that subject. I don't have all the titles with me. Her book, when she wrote that book, she was employed by the Westinghouse Corporation, who was in charge of cleaning up Hanford at that point. And although historians like me are completely objective about everything and see everything clearly and deal only in facts, who employs you sometimes makes a difference. And she's employed by Westinghouse, she's employed by the people that were employed and funded by the federal government. And I guess it depends whether you think historians are objective or whether people don't bite the hand that feeds them. In any event, it's still a fairly good, fairly objective book. You read it, the idea that this is a person who's basically defending what has gone on at Hanford, justifying it, and saying it wasn't quite as bad as we might think it could have been. If you read it that way, there's still a lot of very interesting or startling information in it about that development. As it says on some of these posters, and this may be an overstatement, I don't know, but people claim Hanford is the most polluted spot on the face of the earth. And certainly the nature of the pollution makes it worse than many other kinds of places where the earth is badly polluted. The recent books that have come out on that subject are much more negative and much more on the attack against the government and the whole project. If you get tired of reading, take a break by listening to some of Woody Guthrie's songs. They're now available on cassette and on disc, and on disc also, or the old platters. The songs that Woody Guthrie composed when he was working for the government in the 1930s, the time they were building the Grand Coulee. That's right, some great American folk music. It's worth listening to. It's especially worth listening to because it illustrates what I was saying about optimism. Guthrie's songs are very optimistic about what people can do to solve their problems. And just think back to the words of "Roll on, Columbia, roll on." It's that we're going to build these dams and do all these things and cut the forests and use the river, and it's going to all be wonderful. And finally, a book I'd recommend you look at is called The Good Rain. It's by a journalist named Timothy Egan. And it's about the Pacific Northwest, about the entire Northwest, especially the western side of the state. That's where the title comes from. But the first chapter and the 13th chapter in the book are on the Columbia River. And it gives kind of a travelogue of the river and the developments on it, and a criticism of what's happening along the river. Finally, I have some copies of this in the bookstore. This is called the Columbia River Reader. It's about a dozen articles by different authors on the Columbia. It's sort of mixed, but it's cheap. I don't know what the bookstore is going to sell for. I just gave them a half dozen copies, so they're over there while they last.
Are any of the other books listed in the bookstore?
No.
No.
I don't think so. My book order list got lost in shuffle someplace.
Oh, okay.
I used to carry The Good Rain.
I think there is a copy of that over there. I think I did see one the other day. Yeah.
Would you be willing to briefly mention the books you listed last night?
Sure.
If
I can remember them. Well, I said what I think is the best single book on all aspects of the Columbia, especially the kind of things we'll be talking about today, is by William Dietrich, and it's called Northwest Passage. It's subtitled something like The Columbia River and the History of the Northwest. Northwest Passage. And I think it's very judiciously written and covers a wide range of things, both historically and in terms of topics. The geology book I mentioned is Cataclysms on the Columbia by a man named John Allen and Marjorie Burns. Some of you may not be excited about sitting down and reading a geology book. I can only tell you, when I taught a course on the Columbia River, that was one of the required, about six required texts. And I asked the students at the end of the course their favorite book of all the books they'd read. The vast majority of the class said it was that book. That's the kind of book, if you read it, you'll never look at the landscape of this part of the country the same way again. You'll just never see it the same way. It just changes how what you see, what you perceive. That's what I consider the most powerful kind of books one can read. It's also geology written for the layperson. You don't have to struggle through formulas, and they've got some of that in the footnotes, but the text is very understandable and very readable, and I think very exciting. I think what else did I mention last night? I mentioned a book by John McPhee called The Control of Nature, especially the chapter in it about the attempt to keep the Mississippi River in its present course through the Delta. It was relevant to our studies. That is in the bookstore. There's at least one copy of that in the bookstore. That, too, is a very worthwhile book worth reading. So this book, same kind of thing. If you read it, you really look at things differently afterwards. Okay, this chart's over here. I've got a few extras of these. I'll be glad to give these away at the end of the week or through, if you'd like to take them with them. This is just the flip side of it. This is the entire Columbia River drainage, the seven states and the province of BC that is drained by the Columbia River. I'll repeat those statistics I gave last night. Just to remind everybody, the Columbia River is 1,214 miles long from the very headwaters to the mouth. It falls 2,650 feet. It drains 7 states: Utah, Nevada, Idaho, Wyoming. Doesn't drain the whole state, excuse me. It drains from 7 states: Wyoming, Washington, Oregon, Montana.
And one would include British Columbia.
And British Columbia. And a lot of water from British Columbia. And a lot of controversial water from British Columbia, because the question of who would control this when water goes across a border was a difficult question. There's a book on that, by the way, if you're interested. Rivers don't necessarily follow borders, despite what I was saying last night, or the way I drew that map in there. They usually ignore borders if they get a chance. Or maybe put it this way, humans aren't smart enough to make rivers their borders, make natural borders instead of drawing straight lines on maps. Well, in the Bible, they probably were. I was talking last night, many of the references to rivers in the Bible are to boundaries or limits. You can go this far and no further. We developed a civilization where we like to draw straight lines on everything, set them off. So this is the drainage, and if you read around through this, what this is really a set of woes of the river. These maps are put out by a group called the River Watch. It's an environmental group who happens to think that the river is in very serious trouble and greatly in danger. So they go around each of these things, talk about the negative effects that human activities are having on the Columbia. I'll just read it with that in mind. It doesn't necessarily make it wrong or false or correct for that matter. This map over here, the map of the Columbia River Gorge, is a part up from east of Portland. And I mainly put that up to show how complicated our thinking becomes about these things. This is a land use map of the Columbia River Gorge. Actually, I've got the simplest part of it on the wall. If I flipped it over, it'd be even more chopped up. But all these different colors and lines and things indicate different kinds of land uses and designations, zoning designations, that are going on in the gorge as people try to decide how are we going to treat this land. It is extremely controversial. Very, very bitter, angry battles are being fought over land use here. It's very much like, this probably doesn't mean anything to Scott, but it's a lot like the battle going on in where I live in Whatcom County and in Chelan County over who's going to control land use, who's going to control growth, and how we're going to use the land in the future. So that's the Columbia River Gorge. But this little map, this is a bit, it's sort of the same kind of thing, but it's good for sort of tracing the river and seeing all the development, especially all of the dams on it. Columbia River itself has got about, I think, 14 or 15 dams, and the whole system has got about 70 dams on it, the whole drainage system. We'll talk about that on Friday, we're going to. When we talk about the salmon, we'll have to talk about the extensive dam hydroelectric system that affects the river. You can glance at this little chart and get some idea of how that is. Okay, I'd like to ask you to help out now by doing some thinking. I'd like to make a list of the main and most distinctive interests that different groups have in the river. By interest, I don't mean that it's interesting. I mean that they have some self-interest or economic interest, or put it this way, something to gain what's up for grabs, who has something to gain, or who is using the river in a certain way or that they want to protect. And that's their, what we call their interest in it. So let's just make a list first of the main ones, which we call the interests in the river.
Yeah. Fishing.
Fish. Okay, we're going to simplify this a lot, but that breaks down really fast right away into at least two categories, probably three categories. There's commercial fishing, and then there's sports fishing. Mm-hmm. And they're not compatible always. Mm-hmm.
Recreation. Power.
For electric.
Water power. Electric.
Okay, hydropower.
Transportation.
Transportation. By the way, what are forms of recreation? Can you give us just a couple of examples?
Boating.
Swimming.
Surf riding. Is it surfers?
That's water. That's probably one of the biggest ones today is what's called windsurfing.
Windsurfing.
It takes place down there in the gorge. Thousands of people come on a place called Hood River on some weekends just to windsurf. Okay, transportation. Example?
Oh, the barging up and down.
Okay. Barging, freighters can even go up the river quite a ways. Irrigation. What else?
Lumber.
No, just the river itself. Transporting the lumber would be a use of the river. But, what else?
Water.
For what?
I don't know. It's used other.
What's the first and main thing we want to ever use water for?
Drinking.
Okay, what else?
Disposal. Sewage disposal.
The river is a sewer. It is. What else?
How about the floodplain? You want to include that? Or?
Well, what's the use?
For soil, raising in crops.
I'm thinking mainly just of the water, okay. Just to keep it simple. We will
flood control.
I don't know.
Flood,
flood control.
Is it used for cooling any plants? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Let's just call that industrial. Mm-hmm. These begin to overlap quite a bit. By industrial, I mean cooling. But also steam manufacture, any process that needs water running through the plant for some purpose or another. Okay, that's pretty much covered. There's still one we haven't mentioned.
Cultural? It defines a people?
Let's keep it more hard-nosed than that. We'll get back to that. That's a good point.
The beauty of it. The scenery and the beauty of the river.
Tourism.
Okay, let's put tourism under recreation. And let's hold the beauty of it as being a soft-headed response. Sentimental, bleeding heart. We're talking about dollars and economics. There's one
something
more.
About environmental concerns.
These are all environmental concerns, aren't they?
Oh, well, when I think about environment, I know it's everybody here. I think that means you know, people are concerned with the environment. They're interested because they want to keep it as whatever, as good as possible. When I hear people say, oh, those environmentalists, I die of shock.
This is what the environmentalists have to deal with. There's one more that nobody's mentioned yet.
About erosion.
What's the interest in the people living along the bank and eroded? Yeah? Let's leave that one out.
Okay.
There's another group that has what are called treaty rights in the river. Okay, let's see. We've got fishing, recreation, hydro, transportation, irrigation, drinking water, sewage. Why did you think of that right together? Industrial uses, industrial production, and treaty rights. Fine. Okay. Okay, I'm going to break you into little small groups of about two or three each and give you one of those topics in about 5 minutes. And I want you to, in that time, when we get back together, be willing to state as forcefully as you can and as convincingly as you can why your group's rights are the most important, why they take precedent over, if there has to be a choice, if we can't have all these things and we have to choose, why your group, your rights, your property rights in the river should be first. Okay. Is that clear what I want you to do? Your interest in the river is primary. And what kind of arguments or statements or things can you make to try to convince the rest of us, convince me that, for example, the fish are the most important thing in the Columbia River and need to be protected? Okay. Well, we'll just go in the order we put them down there. Let's see. Two are fish. There's a fish resource. You three together. Recreation. Two back there have hydropower. Transportation. I'm going to break you up. Scott, let you join the two back there for irrigation.
My cup of tea.
And you three here. The drinking water. And three here. The sewer. And you two have industrial uses, and the final three back there have got treaty rights. Okay, should we reassemble? See if we can solve our problem. Okay, let's assume our group is getting together to address the severe problems that the Columbia River faces today. And being human, we're going to, first of all, defend our own interests, look out for ourselves. You don't want to be someone who spent 75 years building a family farm and then just decide to walk away from it because somebody else claims they have a different water right. And but we also know that it's to our advantage to cooperate with other people, to form political alliances with people who have different interests than us, but whose interests are compatible with our own. So as we talk about it, always be protecting yourself, but also be looking for who can you work with. Okay, who'd like to start off saying that their interest in the river is, if not most important, certainly should not be sacrificed?
All right, we're the number one fishing. We're very concerned because the dams and the effect it's had upon the river has decreased the number of fish tremendously. It used to be the Columbia and the salmon, the Snake River had tremendous fishing runs, which we are almost non-existent at the present time.
Who are the dam people? Where are the dam people?
Hydro
people?
Oh, we're all hydro people. Okay. Yeah.
But, you talk to them, not to me.
Okay, and we have, by placing the dams along the river, have made it much more difficult for the adults to return, and we have ruined many of the places that they have spawned. And particularly are we concerned about the young fish, that both steelhead and salmon are returning. Their eggs are hatched, the young fish, in a couple of weeks, months, or a year are coming down the river. I think they're coming down, they're probably hatched in the, 1 year and come down the next, but they're facing, instead of a fast-flowing stream that took them down to the ocean in a given length of time, and it was a short time, now they're having to navigate lakes instead of rivers, and they're coming down the coming to the sea is taking them a great deal of time. And this is a concern both to the commercial fishermen, to the sports fishing, and to the Indians, and I'll leave that to the treaty rights.
With all respect to the fishing, as irrigation, we think irrigation is probably one of the most natural ways to use the river. It's one of the oldest, we go back to Mesopotamia. You notice that getting water to water plants is what rivers are known for. You find green areas around rivers because that's what a river's about. And we take on what you said about the dams. We think dams have added life to the river, and it's a way we can irrigate more. So we appreciate that it's able to do more than just water our fields. We're able to make power. But also with irrigating, we raise the aquifers. We're actually putting water back into the soil instead of letting it go straight back to the sea. We're taking water that was given to us and using it for more. We're getting a lot more out of the river by irrigating.
Irrigation is true, and the primary irrigation comes from Grand Coulee Dam, which cut off, of course, all the spawning in that direction. But it's the dams we've put in since then that are causing our biggest trouble on the fishing. And they aren't being used primarily for irrigation. They're being primarily for hydroelectric power.
But we feel that hydroelectric power is, we feel sorry for these fish. But if we don't have this hydroelectric power, we're not going to have all the jobs that is provided, not only by the power plant itself, but by those who have lights. It lights all complete cities. It provides jobs for production companies and plants, industry. So without the hydro, we wouldn't have all these jobs. We wouldn't have lights and power within our city.
We need the hydroelectric power, not for only the area here, but when there are brownouts in other areas, they can give them power. I sympathize with the fishermen because I have a son who's a fisheries biologist, so I know what the problems are.
But the
Life's fine, but I think we need recreation. Think of all the people you know who have motor homes that go around the whole area. No, anybody intended here. But I mean, you know, and here's a place where it's a good, clean sport. Windsurfing, I understand, is now international in scope. The fame of the windsurfing part. It's economically feasible to go to an area like this for all the recreational possibilities, fishing and water power and so on.
But would the windsurfing be possible without the dams?
Pardon me?
Would the windsurfing be possible without the dams?
No, right. I understand, yes. It isn't a wild one river, but we're
I don't think you could have windsurfed in the Cascades of the
Colorado. No.
But this trivializes the river. The river is, in fact, a great spirit which was there long before Caucasian people came to the West, and we've compromised the most daring part of the river, which is its freedom as a river. We represent the treaty rights of Native Americans who lived along the river, and we feel that we have a prior value which has been overlooked ever since Anglican people came, white people came to the land. And I think that our rights need to be looked at, because if you trample the people who are weak, you end up yourself becoming weaker through that. I think what we're asking for is a river that, one river, one major river in America. We're not talking about the Mississippi, which was wiped out, and our ancestor, our forebears, the native peoples along the Mississippi many years before. What we have here is a river that still can be saved. It's a river where the fish have not been wiped out completely. We still can do something about this. And the trivialization of talking about people's recreation, they can have recreation in the cities, they can have recreation anywhere, but this is a river that represents the spirit of the West and the spirit of an untamed continent, which we native peoples understand and which we have a need for also in terms of our economy for our fishing rights. So we would like to make common cause with the fishing people, because we believe that the fishing people and we are talking about the same thing, which is the power of a river, and that's recreation, not recreation windsurfing or recreation, you know. You can pull up beside a river and have a nice time with your
Yes, I know. I wish we could go back to the days when it was a free-flowing river and all the people, including the Native Americans, could work there and could get their fish and so on, but we can't go back to that anymore. The river is gone.
There's still
popular.
Biologically, we can still save the river.
You
biologically,
might be able to
can
save a part
that's
of
being
it. You can't remove the dams and the water power and all of this.
You have the cheapest electrical power in the nation because of these dams. You have the cheapest. Pay a few pennies more, and you won't have to compromise the river.
I don't see how you could possibly return to the ways of the past, although I would like to. I agree with you.
He doesn't return to the ways of the past. He wants nuclear power.
If we will cut back on our use of electricity, and if we use efficient means of using electricity, we can transform this country so that we no longer need the Columbia in chains.
But what's really energy efficient is transportation.
Yes, I agree with Mr. Chief Running Bear over here.
Yeah, right.
I mean, the dams have got to go. Long before the dams and the fishing poles and anything was
moved. Who are you representing?
And long before the fishing poles and the hydroelectricity, where they can transport, you can transport people through boats on the river. And you can also transport logs, which is a really great thing. You can cut down the logs. The dams are in the way, and we've wiped out several windsurfers already trying to transport logs. So it's a hazard to their health, and it's jamming the plants, and it's not a good thing.
Can you, in any size at all, without the locks and the dams?
I've never been on the river, I don't know.
It's basically a lake. When it was a series of rapids and falls and whirlpools and everything, people used it that way, but they lost a lot of lives.
You know, I'm surprised that transportation doesn't recognize that what it's transporting is grain to a nation. And yeah, Jeff, we can take out these dams and have a river flow free, but you can't enjoy that when you're starving to death. We've made a breadbasket out of central Washington that's able to feed more than just our state and more than our nation.
There are railroad tracks that run parallel to the river. The railroads were perfectly efficient, and they are much more efficient, in fact, than damming the river. And they also don't take the spirit of a whole region out
pollution.
Of that region.
But we all
railroads are still there.
How much we can grow by irrigating, and we added where we can get it by the power people, and we've moved it to Asia. We feed the rest of the world by being able to ship it economically through a transportation system second to none. And sure, fish are nice, and we are also able to. We have put in.
But what about tofu? You know.
Soybeans. I'd be surprised how many soybeans we grow on the irrigated areas of eastern Washington. This is not an area that has not been irrigated before.
Soybeans come from Iowa, man.
All right, but if you're going to take out the dam, I invite every one of you to go to the U.S. government and say, "Oh, hey, we'd like to remove these little impediments in our problems." You know, I'm sure Uncle Sam's going to say, "Why you just go ahead?"
No, Clay Gordon is going to do that. He gave it to Washington.
Come on, sure.
And we create jobs. We create a lot of jobs.
Without drinking water, you don't have to worry about any of that. Because without drinking water, you'd all be dead anyway. So we support the drinking water, taking the Columbia River, and you need that for everything. I mean, without clean water, you can't do recreation, you can't fish, you can't get any of that, and you won't need it because you
have
dehydration.
And I agree with this, because you don't need dams for drinking water. And the faster the water flows, the cleaner the water is. So I agree. And I think the fishing people and the drinking water people and the treaty rights people are really the only people in this room who can agree.
I'm sorry. I think surface water is much more dangerous to drink than well water. And you have to say that irrigation increases the well levels of local communities.
Where does holding this water? What does it do with it?
Surface water.
What does it do with it? You bring it right out of the creek?
Puts it in a tank and puts some chlorine in it.
That's easily fixed. You just purify the water.
What do the sewage people say? Sewer.
Here. You've got all these different systems operating, and you've got a lot of waste material, so you got to flush it out. And so the river has always been a natural way to get rid of it. Dump it in, out of sight, out of mind, and downstream it goes.
Well, I sewer,
if you put the sewer in the river, it'll be dirty, and you know, we're all going to get sick from it.
Well, then you'll have to have treatment plants. But it's cheaper to just put it in the river than to build an expensive treatment plant.
I don't think we have to apologize for sewer. I think great environmentalist Dixie Lee Ray explained to us that sewer is actually a natural part. It adds to the environment and puts effluents back that's able to help things grow. Nutrients.
Not when 3 million people are taking a dump in the river.
We can irrigate with it, don't worry.
I think the
people are the least
careful. Dump it in the river.
It goes to the ground to aquifer.
By sewer, we don't just mean sewage systems, we also mean industrial waste. Everything collects. There's some huge smelters on the river which pour all their effluent right into it.
Yeah, the fish too, darn.
A dab of chlorine doesn't clean all the riverside, an insecticide.
There are no fish above up there anyhow, so that's the one problem helps solve the river. You build a dam, stop the fish, and then you don't worry about the pollution. Okay, anybody else?
Industrial and hydropower, I think.
Well, the only reason we're not speaking up because we've been down a long time ago for the industrialization. We are from rural Iowa, and I'll tell you, it's completely different, so we can't argue for the Columbia River. It goes along
with the hydro.
It goes along with the hydro, yeah. I mean, you know. Yeah, we've got other problems.
We've been hog plants coming in.
We have a lot of problems, so you can't relate.
We're saying that people are going to want to get into the great outdoors and
whitewater river
camping.
Don't need the dams for what?
Right. And river and recreation and
beauty at the same time.
Beauty. So you can go to the river and recreate yourself with the Native Americans. They love it and we would love it because you can swim and drink.
That's true. Recreation. Drink the water.
Whose side am I on? I don't know.
What do you say to people who think a lake is more beautiful than a flowing stream? You think the river's beautiful the way it is now. It's a big, winding body of water right up through this desert country.
Right. Yeah, it needs a little bit of treatment, like chlorination for some of it.
I'm just talking about the beauty.
Oh, the beauty, yeah.
The dams may have enhanced the beauty of the river.
It's beautiful anyway, despite all that all people have done. To, you know, start contaminating.
Well,
so it's a gift for making
recreation.
Is
one severe drought, and I think you have people crying for your irrigation because of the lack of water, and that's one of the essentials of maintaining the economy for an area, and in this area here with your crops and some food and so forth. But irrigation is essential.
You know, they just drink or don't worry about eating anything anyway.
I remember. Could you use the analogy, though, of an economy as an obese person who continually, who would feel very, very anxious about decreasing their obesity, but their obesity is in fact killing them and will knock 10, 20 years off of their life. So do we want to continue to feed an already obese economy by continuing to sacrifice the things that make our country attractive, actually, wonderful, amazing, a gift from God, sacrifice those to an already obese economy because we're anxious about losing some weight economically?
You know, it's funny that if people are obese to talk about the beauty of the land. When we're talking about irrigating and feeding starving people, I think it's tough to listen to people talk about getting back to beauty when people are starving to death. And we're talking about feeding people. And I guess when you're starving, you don't get to talk about the beauty. When you're starving, you don't get to talk about pristine, great wilderness. When you're starving, you're looking for food.
The wheat that we're selling is not going to starving people. It's making pasta for the
Asians.
For people all over America. And there may be some going to Asians, but we can cut back our needs and still send a lot to Asia without irrigation.
I think we have to look at the numbers, just how much we've increased our production.
I'm talking about the Great Plains. I'm not talking about Eastern Washington.
I thought we were talking about the Columbia.
Yeah. You're talking about feeding hungry people. I'm saying we can feed hungry people on what we've got in the Midwest if we cut back our economy. And
yeah,
our own
we've got to transport down the river first.
Got to look at it from a global perspective is what the man over here is saying. So I'm trying to look at it from a global perspective, not just from Eastern Washington perspective. We're trashing our river because we want to keep our economy in Washington going, but our economy, we're doing well in Washington. We can cut back. We can pay more for electricity. We can find different kinds of lifestyles. This is what Jesus calls us to do. And Wakantanka, the Great Spirit, calls us to this.
What are some of the other tribal interests in the river? Can you, besides the one you've listed? This is a traditional, it's called a traditional Indian speaking. How would a more progressive member of your tribal council talk about the treaty rights?
Didn't they sell a lot of their treaty rights? Weren't they paid for
no.
a lot of them?
No.
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 No, they still have them.
Okay.
Well, I have to say the Wapatos are real proud of what we've done. They've made a very economically viable tribe out of themselves by being able to
build up Wapato Point, which is irrigated land, I believe.
So you think their treaty rights are being satisfied?
Yeah, I think
a great chief
who looks out for their people is going to also want to fed people and going to want people that are not still scratching out a living on the dry banks of a river. They want people who are up with today's society living a healthy life.
That has something to drink.
Water, that is.
Water. Okay. Even if you're not, without clean water, you won't have the fruit to produce juice to drink. Or if you don't have clean water, you can't go to the cows to get milk either. So, without water, there's no way that you'll have anything to drink.
But we can fix that. We can fix almost anything if we want to. One of the things that's hard to fix, though, are the fish. We may have to trade off the fish. We'll talk about that on Friday. Let me ask one final question to think about. See if it can confuse it even more. Before I do have to say one quotation I heard from a farmer. I was talking about this issue, along the line of what Scott's saying. He's an apple grower just down below Chelan here, and I was talking to him about the salmon problem, and he just shook his head and he said, "I just can't understand why people consider fish more important than food." Okay, final question. We've looked at all these different interests that humans have in the river. Does it make any sense at all to say that we should also take into consideration that the river has an interest in itself? That the river has an interest in being itself. Does that make any sense, or is that just gobbledygook? Jeff, you were saying something very, very close to that.
It's a question of the integrity of the river as a whole. What you end up doing is you end up breaking the river into little lakes or little economically productive units.
Components.
But the river as a whole, what the river spent millions of years developing was a kind of community which it hosted and which it lived on. And that is being lost, that integrity or that large picture. So the river, it would be like saying, could you be yourself without your arm? Or could you be yourself without your spouse and children? And the answer that everybody is giving as they break up the river is yes, of course. The sum of the parts is greater than that of the whole. But I'm saying, or what you want to say from an ecological perspective, is that the whole has a kind of integrity which, when you break it into parts, much is lost, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is it, maybe it's worth losing, though. I mean, you might give up a kidney to save a loved one, or sacrifice
right.
part of your body.
Right.
If the purpose is good enough.
Right.
In fact, you'd sacrifice your own life if it's for the benefit of those you love.
Okay.
If it's an act of love. Maybe the river's committing an act of love and sacrificing itself.
Bob, I switch away from this old role, which I didn't like, saying that I think if we say we can break it up, we're trying to say we know more than we do. To dream that we can guess at what the river would want or what the river's potential is, we put dams on it, find out that, it does kind of kill off the salmon. I don't know if we could ever stop the river from being what it wanted to be. It's filling up behind the dams now. It's going to do it. To think, I think that's egotistical, to think that we can stop the river from doing what it wants. It's been here for thousands of years and will continue to be. When you look at the scab lands of eastern Washington, we're joking to say that we can't. The question is, for the short time that we're around, can we tweak it? Is all we can do, because this river is going to be here forever. It's whether we're going to be able to live with it.
So does it follow from that, can we conclude from that, that doesn't make any difference what we do to it? Because in the long run, it's really going to restore itself and get back to whatever its, quote, natural state is.
I think we need to be self-centered enough to say that, what are we doing to it that's going to kill us off? Because we can put these dams on it, but those dams are going to be gone in 1,000 years, as are we. But what are we doing to our quality of life, and what are we doing to ourselves by putting those dams there?
And our children and grandchildren.
Right, because that river is going to flow wherever it wants eventually. But how are we hurting ourselves by doing these things? So I would hope we would, you know, I think we can look at all these things.
Do you think it hurts us to not be able to see and experience the Columbia as a free-flowing river, as a powerful, almost being of its own, like it once flowed? Does that cost us something?
I think it does. I think salmon are like the spotted owl. They're just one indicator of what's dying there. That could be part of our life. Sure, we can see salmon because they're huge, but what else is dying that could maybe be helping us or maybe be adding energy to our lives instead of B-52 bombers, which we built?
Instead of looking at the plight of the Native Americans and Native people who suffer from, not only our country, but we have so many resources of the nation that I think the Indians were right. But, I don't see how we can return to that stage, and I don't know if I'm making sense or not. Anyway, I agree with the Native Americans, but I don't know if we can get back to the way it used to be. To me, it sounds not possible.
One of the big questions that we'll deal with this in a later session is whether we can change just a little or just enough to keep the salmon in a river. Well, that doesn't mean taking all the dams or totally transforming the river. We don't know, but can we begin to make some slight changes to make it more likely the salmon will survive? Or do we say it's all over for the salmon? And that's part of the problem with the temporary, with the long-range view you're taking is with species extinction. The salmon are gone. After everything has changed 1,000 years from now, 2,000 years from now, the salmon will not be back if they're really gone, if we manage to totally extinguish them.
Do you think the salmon were here 5,000 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Really, when did the Columbia stop going down to the Bonneville and start going through the Cascades?
A long time ago.
Okay, if I go to glaciation and say 10,000 years, would that be a fair thing? That,
time of the melting out of the ice and the glaciers.
So 10,000 years?
Yeah, 12,000 years.
Okay, the salmon weren't there before then, I assume.
Oh, well, that's the last one.
But Rudy's going to speak to that. Did it change, of course?
Sure. Jeff,
go ahead. Well, what I was going to say is we just, again, this morning bombed Iraq, and it reminds me that we spent an enormous amount of money in, what was it, 2 weeks or 3 weeks, 5 years ago, 4 years ago, and we would probably say that we, if we had to count the money and the resources that go into something like that, we'd probably say we can't afford that, but yet we do it. So there are certain things that we do in our nation that we really can't afford, but you know, like military buildup. If we took that same amount of energy, in 2 weeks we could have a free-flowing Columbia River. If we really put our minds to it, I probably wouldn't want to do it in 2 weeks, but if you wanted to, it would probably incur some damage that we wouldn't want to incur, but I think that we as a nation can take up some of these causes if we could care about them. I don't think it's that we can't do it. I think it's that we can't envision it. We can't envision giving up cheap electricity, and that's what breaks my heart, is that we can't envision paying a little bit more for electricity so that these species could be safer. We cannot envision that.
I,
you know, you mentioned Iraq, and maybe we're all going to, you know, be on one side or the other about bombing Iraq, but Hitler to me seems to be a much more clouded issue. And just to say that we don't need it now is to forget that when the Grand Coulee Dam was built, it was built to feed people, but it ended up being a power supply to make airplanes for Boeing, which made America strong enough to stop Hitler. It's one thing to say we're stopping Saddam Hussein. It's another to look back in perspective and say, we needed that at one time. It doesn't seem simple enough to say we can just stop doing that. What would have happened in 44 if we didn't have these airplanes? Would we be free enough to even debate this now?
No.
Well, if you want to add another irony to it, the dams, the aluminum plants being there, making the aluminum, probably saved the old growth forests on the Olympic Peninsula, which were a lot of spruce trees, which were up to that time used for manufacturing airplanes. We wouldn't be able to make the kind of airplanes we did, but that's what allowed them to create Olympic Park and save the old growth trees. Well, the point of all this was to show that things are complicated and interrelated and interlocked, and it's more difficult to fix them than the film last night indicated. One final thing, we'll break for lunch. Tonight, in the fireside room, after the Vesper service, we're having a community forum, and the topic is going to be a film about the Columbia River, mainly about the fishery of the river. It will give you some historical background. We'll look at that film, and then we'll have the forum discussion. So try to make that if you can. Tomorrow night, tomorrow we'll be back here at 10:30, and we'll talk about the native uses of the river, American Indian uses. Okay? Thank you.